You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with artist Buzz Spector. Buzz, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about what you're doing now. What projects are you working on now, or what's happening in your studio?
Brainerd, I just finished making an artist book at the Center for Book and Paper Arts in Chicago, working with Brad Freeman, a fabulous offset printer and artist himself. And it's got a long and cumbersome title on the page at the back of the book, but my method for generating that title was to cut the last lines of dust jacket blurbs and compose all of the writing in my book using only that material.
That sounds interesting, and that's what's happening right now.
That's right. I've actually been working with dust jacket elements pretty seriously now since the late 1980s. I know I'm probably better known to the small group of people who actually know me for the pages I've torn out of books to transform them into sculptures, but of course, there's all this other material that comes with the books I select, and I've been enjoying composing images and texts using all the elements that you can find on commercially produced dust jackets.
And essentially, you're deconstructing kind of how a whole book is put together and reusing elements of it to what end? It's sculptural, it's aesthetic, you're talking about all the elements of a book.
Well, I see it at its root as being conceptual. What's my expertise here? I'm a very good tearer of pages, I suppose, or a very good stacker of books in my installations. But when we think about virtuosity, we don't go there. And I'm interested in something else, a set of ideas about books as concretizations of memory, of every book as somehow equivalent to a human life, and how working with the book is a way of giving form to ways of thinking about remembering, and probably, since I'm always excising material, thinking about forgetting.
Right, because memory is such a kind of elusive concept, really. I was just talking with a writer who was saying, she wrote a memoir that was kind of non-narrative because he said memory doesn't really work that way. Memory just kind of bubbles up here and there. It's kind of an odd thing to explore. So then maybe we should talk a little bit about installations. How do installations explore that kind of memory, the stacking, I see books when I look at your installations or torn paper books. I look at books as in the context of what a lot of book artists, as they're called now, have done for years, and it's a combination of deconstructing a book and redefining what a book is to most people, because for most people there's a paperback, there's maybe a deluxe edition, now there's Kindle and everything else, but then there's something else that artists do as well as yourself, which is transform the book into a sculptural object, really.
Yes, and those of us who are doing that have some idea of reading in mind. It's all well and good to carve away chunks of stone or wood to, shall we say, unlock the inner artifact. I think it was said of Michelangelo that he saw the sculptures in the marble, and I like to say of John McCracken that he saw the surfboard in the formica. But really, when you work with a book, you always work with the history of its reading, and the memory of reading informs, I think, even the most radical deconstructions of the book form.
The memory of reading, and isn't it also the memory of or representative of culture itself. I mean, part of the tearing out of pages seems, the book almost seems like a sacred object, unlike a lot of other common objects, that it shouldn't be burned, it shouldn't be torn. Is it also, do you see it as an object that it is about memories, but also about a kind of representation of a culture? It's who we are, right? When if we wanted to destroy a culture, we destroy their books, their history.
Yeah, I think about the Nazi book burnings as paradigmatic in that sense. And Misha
right.
Ullman's great memorial to this is a subterranean monument in a Platz in Berlin, and you look from street level down into an abyss of empty shelves. It's really creepy and magnificent simultaneously. When I'm stacking books, I aim for simple architectonic structures that are in their entirety a kind of meditation on how it is you'd organize everything you've read in your mind. So the early forms of my book stacks were often ramps or mastabas, or even in one case a ziggurat, always to engender in viewers the notion they could climb this and in so doing see further. This is, of course, a metaphor of book learning and of experience in general.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Let's move back to the beginnings. What got you involved in books? We could go far as back as, what kind of a household did you grow up in? Was there a lot of books? And
books were semi-sacred objects in my house. Very early on I learned not to chew in them, not to color in them. I have vivid early memories of my mother reading me excerpts from a book of the Arabian Nights. I think Arthur Rackham was the illustrator. And a way to manage my whereabouts during my obstreperous childhood was to put me down in front of enough books that I could be distracted by reading for hours. I was okay with that.
And what books distracted you then? Was it all kinds of books, or was there, I don't know what ages we're talking about. I suppose preteen or around that?
Yeah, preteen. And I think at the time, there was less competition from television or screen technology. So I could go very far with my interests, and my tastes were wide-ranging. Science, fiction, poetry, you name it. I tried reading it.
And if you weren't doing that, what was your mother preventing you from doing with all of these books?
getting into home pyrotechnics.
Okay, so that's also sculptural and relates in terms of it being time-based, if you're serious about that.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
So did you have an interest in pyrotechnics, seriously, or were you just kind of playing with matches kind of thing?
Well, actually, once my brother and I took all of our plastic models of World War II battleships and coated them with the glue we'd used to build them, stuck them in the bathtub, and filled the tub to the brim so that we could crouch there like miniature U-boat captains as they burned and sank. My mother came home from work, and we had cleaned up all the evidence as far as we could see. Nonetheless, within minutes, the voice of doom came from that bathroom, and my brother and I showed up all Bambi eyes. What? And she didn't say a word. She simply pointed at the ceiling, which, of course, was blackened by all that burning plastic.
Right. So then moving forward, what happens next? In high school, college, when was it that you began to take an interest in the book conceptually or as a form, as a
medium?
I
didn't see how I could integrate the form of the book in my studio practice, but I was interested in linking language to art making through language-based art and through my own interest in editing a magazine of artist writings called White Walls, which I started with my friends Reagan and Roberta Upshaw when we were in graduate school at the University of Chicago in the mid-1970s. And I edited White Walls for 10 years. We published, I think, actually a fair number of people you've interviewed on your show over that time. And nonetheless, I was several years into my work as an editor when I had the idea of making an eccentrically shaped book of drawings. All the work I was doing at the time was still drawing-based, and I had an idea of making a book of drawings adapted from a great John Keats sonnet called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. This is the sonnet that begins, "Much have I traveled in the realms of gold," and concludes with the line of stout Cortez and his men, who eye each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. And they're silent, of course, because they're the first Europeans to cross the crest of that hill in Panama and see the Pacific Ocean. It was Balboa, actually, but Keats is not a scholar. He was a poet. So the book of drawings was going to use this device of every successive page being a little longer than the one before it, so that the kind of process-oriented shading I was doing would look like ocean waves bound on the cover. You know, the cover would be embossed with the words simply, Chapman's Homer, and you'd open it up, and there'd be this ocean of gray. So, nice visual idea, right? But how to bind the book so that it didn't get all wonky. And so I thought I would make a maquette of what I had in mind for William Anthony, the great bookbinder who I worked with in those days. And I started tearing pages out of an old printed book that I had. And Brainerd, I get about 30 pages into this systematic tearing of pages out, and I start having what feels a lot like a drug flashback. Every time I tear a page, it's as if the letters on the edges of each torn sheet are scrambling like ants around to form themselves back into words. It was a creepy and fascinating effect, and by the time I finished tearing the pages out of that book, it was the work. So there is no book of drawings called Chapman's Homer. Instead, there was this bizarre and mutilated artifact in my hand, and I'm really, I guess I'm insatiable to repeat that experience, and I've altered maybe 150 books since then.
That's very interesting to speak of it almost as a kind of a flashback, a kind of a trippy-like experience, because it's when all the pages are ripped, it's hard to see where the edges are, where the words end and others begin, and the boundaries, as we know them in books, are suddenly altered, as well as our whole, I suppose, cognitive experience in figuring out how to read this thing, which is kind of impossible, but at the same time, it looks as though it is possible.
Well, reading is an ultimately optimistic activity. I mean, think about it. Every morning, you pour yourself a bowl of cereal and read the back of the box again, as if maybe on the 100th reading, some Kabbalic mystical experience will enrich your mind while you're there getting your morning carbs.
That's true. It's interesting how the same thing could be reread multiple times and suddenly new meanings emerge. So that project that you're talking about, that launched you into the medium that you've inhabited all these years, which is essentially book arts, right?
Right.
And then how is it that?
At first, I didn't understand why book artists were wanting me to be part of the genre, since the endeavor I was involved in was unmaking books rather than building them up. But I understand now the larger issue. And besides, I also make my own books now, as well as altering found printed books.
So I'd like to talk about how the sculptural project started, but I'd also like to discuss a little bit. I mean, book art seems to me to be, if that term is okay, or artist books, is almost as the way photography was maybe 50 years ago. It still seems to be, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but ghettoized a little bit. It's not taken with the same seriousness, perhaps, or doesn't get the same, perhaps with the same seriousness, but doesn't seem to get the same kind of play that a lot of large-scale visual art works. I remember when I was in college, and I went to SUNY Purchase, and I had a teacher, Jan Gruber, a fantastic photographer.
Oh, absolutely.
Antonio Frasconi was there, and other good bookmakers, and I remember she was doing the beautiful book of platinum prints and letterpress, and granted, it was something of a deluxe book as opposed to an artist book. She thought of it as an artist book, but she said when she was done with the editions, one of her collectors said, you know, this was a foolish thing to do. I don't care if Jan Gruber prints are normally $3,000 a piece, and you're selling a book of 20 for $10,000, which already is, you know, a dramatic reduction in price. He said, unless I cut this whole book up, it's not of value to me, and nobody's going to buy it. And she said, sure enough, nobody really did buy my book. Is that part of the issues of artists making books, or am I on a tangent there?
Well, it's a valid point, but it's circumscribed by spectacle. Artist books just don't look very good on the wall. You can't see anything that's going on in them, and if they're going to be at all functional as books, they're way too small for a collector who wants to back up 20 feet and has a room that large to look at a trophy. The recent history of artist books has been fraught with episodes of breaking through in public consciousness. Diderot's experimental books in the 50s, Ed Ruscha's 26 gasoline stations in the 60s, the courtship and dialectical relationship of fine books to fine printmaking in the 70s and 80s. You know, there's all these episodes in the book being used by artists, but for books to maintain what matters for us with them is really always going to get in the way of the means by which we expect to look at art, which is standing upright in a gallery or museum.
Well, and it's also much more intimate experience, right? I mean, there's something so intimate about a book that you have to hold it, that you have to touch it. Do you think it has also to do with the demand on the viewer, which is somewhat greater than a sculpture or a painting that's hanging on the wall?
Well, that's such a good question. Sometimes when I'm giving a public talk about my work or the book arts in general, I remind my audience of how many times they've had the experience of reading a book and being so wrapped up in it that suddenly it was hard to read because night had fallen and they'd never turned on the lights. And then I say, what's the longest amount of time you've spent looking at an artwork? And almost always people will say things like, well, maybe 15 minutes at the Met, or, you know, half an hour at a Museum of Contemporary Art, or, of course, none of this is true. The most time that we spend looking at works of art would be the time we spend looking at works of art in our homes, right? The art we own. And then the differences in the amount of time spent with a book versus the amount of time spent with an artwork disappear entirely. Our cultural association of the art world as manifest producer of spectacles somewhat corrupts the way we ought to be thinking about works of visual art in concert with other art experiences. And we take all these things in individually. They stir us individually before we join a chorus of those appreciating or sneering at this production.
That's true. And in your, as we go through your career, when was the first installation or stacking of books that you did, and how did that come about from the, you know, departing from the first kind of torn, altered book that you discussed earlier?
Well, the very first time I showed a stack of books as an artwork was at the Hyde Park Art Center in Chicago in 1986. For almost 2 years before then, I'd been building an enormous book structure in the loft I was living at in the Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago. I'd come into possession of more than 2,000 discarded books, and I lived in a large enough loft space with an agreeable enough loft mate to let me occupy a lot of floor space with various configurations of this book. And it was not a public artwork. I mean, it was just my friends who came by, but of course they told other friends about it. And after a test run at the Hyde Park Art Center, I built a very large book structure at Randolph Street Gallery, an alternative space in Chicago, almost 5,000 books in that structure. And that really was kind of a breakthrough for me. It attracted a lot of curatorial attention, including Neil Ben Ezra at the Art Institute, who invited me to do a variation of it as part of a series of contemporary projects there. And so in January 1988, I had my first major museum show, a stack of books called The Library of Babel.
And how was that received?
It was received, I think, really, really well by the public. But Chicago, being Chicago, none of the local critics wrote a word about it, and it convinced me that it was probably time to leave the Midwest. So I moved to L.A., and I think I did several major book stacks out there and really established myself as an artist in so doing.
And that's interesting. There was a very different reception on the West Coast, you found, for that work?
Yeah, I there's jokes about how nobody reads in L.A. That's not true at all. The art scene I arrived in the late 80s was, I think, on its way to reshaping the international art world. You know, Mike Kelly was active. John Baldessari was a major figure there. Al Ruppersberg, Doug Hubler, Michael Asher, the women associated with a half a dozen of the feminist co-ops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very active time there. That was such an exciting time to enter into the scene there, I imagine. Wow. What I wonder is, when people are looking at these installations and getting involved in them, was there any talk about the content of it? I mean, for me, when I begin to look at stacks of books, I start reading spines. And I know that, in a way, the content is divorced from the installation, but or is it, you know, when there is so much text still exposed in some of those books?
Well, in most of the book installations I've done, randomness is perceivable pretty easily. But there are other modes I've employed. I stacked all the books in my personal library in order of the height of the spine, from the tallest to the shortest, on a single shelf in a room large enough to hold them. And, of course, a work like that is absolutely about the titles on the spine, about about how you can read a life into this panorama of ownership of books.
Right, it's kind of a portrait of the owner. If you went to other people's libraries and did the same, we'd have a, in a sense, a portrait of the owner.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my title was Unpacking My Library, after the great Walter Benjamin essay of the same title.
Right. And so, you're I'm sorry, go on.
You know, I'm hopeful that somebody will commission me to design a library for them in which I can arrange all of their books on a single shelf, even if it means knocking holes in the walls of all the rooms in the apartment.
Oh, that sounds like a great commission. So, well, in the apartment or building a structure for them to house that. Essentially, it's like building a library, a horizontal one, but it's almost like commissioning a construction of a library, right?
Yes, yes.
And when you were in L.A., what happened next? That's a very exciting group of people you're with. You're exhibiting there more. You've had a museum show, and more people are interested in the work. What was the next pivotal point for you, you think, in terms of that kind of work, as you kept making more installations and projects?
Well, the response to the work was good enough, although economically, I had some pretty lean years out there as well. When I went into full-time teaching, that involved, of course, leaving L.A. And but as it is, I love teaching, and I've enjoyed doing it over the years since then. And you know, I'm of an age now where I can look forward to the end of my job in the rank and file. And the sad part would be stepping away from the studio. But I have to say, Brainerd, I rarely teach courses about making books. Often, the best teaching I've done, at least in my own view, is teaching about the idea of books and how it is we employ them as critical as well as cultural forms.
And so when you retire, you're in Chicago now, correct?
No, actually, I'm in St. Louis.
You're in St. Louis.
Yeah, I'm a professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
And how do you like that as opposed to L.A.? I mean, that was such a vibrant scene there. You left that scene and came to St. Louis. Wasn't that a radical shift in the
Brainerd, I'm living testimony to the virtues of itinerancy. I left L.A. in 94 for the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and I taught there until 2001, and then went to Cornell, and I taught in Ithaca for 8 years at Cornell before accepting the offer to come to Washington University in St. Louis.
So you were back traveling around the Midwest again?
That's right.
And did you like that again? Did you were able to embrace that again, or was that with
Well, you know, I'm a native Midwesterner, and there's some great things happening in St. Louis. The art scene here reminds me strongly of the coalescing energy I saw in Chicago in the early 1980s. More good young artists are sticking around after they finish art school. More artist-independent projects are springing up around the community. There's a great lead museum, the St. Louis Art Museum, with a new wing of modern and contemporary art. There's an incomparable private museum, the Pulitzer Foundation, to support it. And my favorite museum, the Contemporary Art Museum St. Louis, where one of my torn paper works is currently on view in Kelly Schindler's exhibit, Occupational Therapy.
That's exciting. Yeah, I'd like to see that. I've honestly never been to St. Louis, but the way you describe it, it sounds wonderful, and that there's a vibrant culture there, especially for young artists. Is that
absolutely.
Correct?
And this is an open-ended invitation. There's a lot of stuff going on here right now.
Really interesting. And do you feel, in the time that you've seen, has the idea of the book as art object, or as you've even been discussing it with your class, has that definition changed much in the last 20 years?
Oh, I think there's been huge shifts in the way we think of books and the way artists employ them now. The rise of screen technology and the web has actually shifted a lot of work that we might have seen in the before 1990 in book form into websites, into digital art of one kind or another. And yet, I think there's more artists working with material books now than ever before. And some of that has to do with a broader understanding of this haptic quality and what it means to have paper nestled in one's hands as distinct from a mouse in front of a screen. So I hate to sound like a fetishist, but there is something to be said for all of us in bodies, all of us with arms and hands and blood and our senses and a unique cultural form which will not speak to us unless we embrace it literally with our hands.
And also, do you find, I mean, among your students or among the book arts world, there seems to be a relationship that maybe it's something I'm just seeing that's not necessarily a pattern, but that many artists who work with books are also involved in installations or video and film work, kind of time-based narrative mediums.
Oh, I see that too, and the book has always been a time-based medium. First this page, then that. In fact, everybody's introduction to the concept of time in a reading culture is as a very small child being read to by someone who loves you. And as the page turns, it's not simply that this happens and then that happens, but that a moment passes. I have children, and all of them have demonstrated to me the desire to have me turn back. And then turn again, and turn back, and turn again. And at about the same age, all just a little more than a year. Why that gesture then? I believe they're figuring out that the page means a time has passed.
And you're saying they have to turn back. You mean to reread a page?
Absolutely.
It's true. It's almost the way you describe it there. It almost sounds like a kind of a time portal, a way of managing time or changing the way we perceive time. Because unlike most other things, we can't go back. But with books, we can.
Yes, we can. Just a little.
Just a little bit.
I like rereading favorite books, you know?
I do too. Well, I mean, I do that more with poetry. I haven't reread, you know, biographies or novels very often. But I suppose if I did, I would get a completely different understanding of them the next time I read them.
Well, I like rereading my favorite poetry too.
So what is next? As this has been great talking to you.
Thank you.
You told me at the beginning, you know, about what you're doing now. I have the sense that you would be retiring soon, and if I'm wrong, correct me. But what do you see happening in your future if you are retiring? Would you be moving, traveling? What's happening?
Yes, all of the above. In the very near term, I've got a small show of my book related work at the Center for Book Arts that opens in early October. And I'm this year's master faculty fellow there, and I'll actually be giving a talk about ways of working with found printed books. Over the longer term, I'm putting together a book of essays. I've had good conversations both with Steve Clay at Granary Books and with the University of Chicago Press about collecting my critical writings, and I'm looking forward to developing more works in my studio once I have more time for that endeavor.
Buzz, thanks so much for talking with me today. It was really a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Brainerd. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.